hinges creak in doorless chambers, and strange and frightening sounds echo through the halls whenever candlelights flicker, where the air is deathly still. That is the time when ghosts are present, practicing their terror with ghoulish delight. There's no turning back now.
Just after sundown, when darkness creeps over the land, the dark figures lurk in the shadows. The fangs glisten in the moonlight, and the ghosts of the world become restless. We begin our journey. Join us as we travel into the world of the paranormal, the supernatural, and the bizarre on Night Watch with your host, Todd Sheets.
Hello and welcome to Night Watch. I'm your host, as always, Todd Sheets, here with my wonderful co-host, Hugh McClanahan.
Yep, I'm still here.
Yeah, and Chris Weisbach.
Oh, good evening.
How are you doing, guys?
I'm good.
Hugh, how are you?
I'm doing good.
Hugh was having some haggis before the show, and Amanda says, "What's haggis? Is that a German taco?"
Whatever. What is
haggis? I was like, "What is it? Come on.
How what? Do you,
never. Is Hugh eating, from Germany? Is
he
Hugh German?
A taco.
If he's eating haggis, you know he's Scottish.
It sounds like
a taco is not Scottish.
A taco isn't even close to Scottish.
But he was eating a taco. Well,
never
why are you
mind.
Saying it was the closest? Why are you making fun of me then?
That's terrifying.
It couldn't be German and it can't be Scottish. He was a Scottish guy eating a taco.
Oh my
but
goodness.
But he said haggis. Come on.
It's gotten all bad.
He's
it's gotten all
haggis.
Bad. It's just terrible. Well, everybody, I'm very excited about the first half of the show because one of my favorite subjects, and one that is boggling to the mind, of course, is quantum physics and all things to do with parallel universes and just really everything involved in physics and how it's such an evolving field these days. And our guest tonight is going to be talking to us about some of this stuff. Everybody, welcome to the show, Steve Manley. Steve.
Hey.
Hey, how are you doing tonight?
Doing good. I'm just wondering if I'm the ho guest. If he's
you don't want to go there.
You know, here on this show, anything is possible. Anything is possible. Keep that in mind. Yeah, I honestly, I'm so excited about this subject. Why don't we let you kind of tell all of our friends out there a bit about yourself and the subject, and we'll take it from there.
Oh, okay. I can do that. I have a PhD in particle physics. I mean, so I'm one of these atom smasher guys for my day job. And in doing so, I did learn a lot about bits of quantum mechanics and a little bit of cosmology. But what I do is I look at particles interacting at very, very high energies. And it actually ties together with, I mean, certainly quantum mechanics is a big piece of that. But it also ties together with cosmology because since we live in an expanding universe, if you go back in time, the universe used to be much hotter and denser, which means the interactions between the particles that existed at that time are more similar to what we can produce in our high-energy accelerators than what you see in everyday life. So as we look at the processes that exist at high energies, we're actually studying effects that happen in the early stages of the universe. I thought I would make this very accessible, more accessible than most of the stuff you would find on the market. And then I tried to sell it, and it turns out the editors and the publishers kept saying, well, that book's out there. It's physics for poets, or it's physics for dummies. And the truth is, if you look at most of the books that are out there, they really aren't telling a coherent story of discovery. in science. They're telling bits and pieces of sort of boring things, many of them. And so I don't think the book is out there, but they said it was. And so I was chatting with my agent. I was very dejected. And every time I'd chat with my agent, he would say, "You know what, Steve? You should write a book about the multiverse." And I said, "What do I know about the multiverse?" And so we'd have another conversation. He'd say, "You should write a book about the multiverse." So finally, just to shut him up, I actually looked into it for a week. And at the end of a week, I realized there really was a book to be written, because it turns out that there isn't just one concept of a multiple universe reality out there. There are many different concepts of a multi-universe reality that are out there. So I did a PhD at Columbia, then moved to Yale and was on the faculty there for 10 years, and moved to the University of Rochester, where I've been since 1998. And I'm working in neutrino physics on an experiment in Japan. I'm one at Fermilab right now, and in the past I've worked at a number of other accelerators.
Having done a lot of chemistry stuff and taken, you know, quantum chemistry, and I know how complex and scary the quantum physics is.
Very involved.
Yeah.
Not for the faint of heart.
That's right.
So what you do, Steve, is that somewhat of an offshoot of kind of what they're doing with the colliders, the super collider, like the Hadron Collider?
Well, it's really exactly that stuff. I don't happen to work at the Large Hadron Collider at CERN, but I do. Basically, anyone outside of the business would see what I do as more or less identical to that. I work on slightly different experiments. I work on one in Japan where we shoot a beam of neutrinos from the east coast of Japan through the rock up into the mountains of the west coast of Japan, and we look and see how particles called neutrinos change as they propagate. And at Fermilab, I'm working on a similar experiment. So it's really sort of the same kind of stuff. We're trying to understand the nature of forces and the nature of matter and how all of that fits together. And as I mentioned a little while ago, that actually feeds into our understanding of the earliest stages of the universe.
This whole universe is such a new discovery for us as engineers, as scientists, as people. And every day it seems like you're learning new things to the point where, let's say, a predominant amount of the old physics rules seem to be going the way of the dinosaur.
Well, you know, it's funny because it does sometimes seem that way. On the other hand, when you look at it, a lot of the stuff really has stuck, and it's stuck very well. There are a lot of fundamental principles that we hold very, very dear. Relativity, conservation of energy, things like this. But it is a changing and exciting field. Some of why I think it may seem scary to many people is there are layers and layers of language and lingo. You know, when you've spent years learning that language, it's not so bad. So one of the problems that we have in dealing with society, really, is the fact that it becomes difficult sometimes to explain things without using the lingo when you're really used to it, because it's a bit of a convenience, and you get so used to it, you sort of forget how it was when you didn't know it.
Right.
When they have terms like quantum entanglement, that doesn't exactly add to my comfort level. So
that's right. That's a fun one.
You know, let's talk about that.
But Steve, kind of go through how this has developed, you know, since the days of Einstein. I mean, from what I understood, Einstein wasn't really big on the whole quantum theory. I mean, did that kind of go against, you know, the general theory of relativity?
Well, physicists as a whole have always wanted to sort of explain the universe. And prior to quantum mechanics and Einstein, prior to the start of the 1900s, what we had were a series of enormously wonderful successes in physics. Newton had developed mechanics, and through mechanics we could understand the physics that it took to do basic mechanical engineering, build buildings, lob a a shell from a cannon and you know hit a gnat from 20 miles. I mean, people had amazing success with mechanics, and it was very deterministic. I mean, given the forces and the motion of something, you could calculate exactly where it's going to go. And then on top of that, Maxwell and others pulled together, they synthesized the theory of electromagnetism. And again, it was very deterministic and extraordinarily successful. If you take those two things and you take Newtonian's theory of gravity, you basically can explain almost everything in our collective experience with enormous success. And it basically explains pretty much everything that is in the realm of normal experience. So you begin to get weirdness when you look at things in far more details. When you begin to look at things that depend on things being very small, like the structure of the atom in detail. If you look at things that are going very fast, things begin to break down. So that led to Einstein's theory of relativity. So it's when we begin to venture away from our comfort zone, in a sense, that things begin to be counterintuitive, and that basically is the seed of the revolution, the modern physics revolution in the 1900s.
Yeah.
So just to sort of pull this back a little bit to the multiverse, to begin to think about what we mean when we talk about the multiverse, or what kind of ideas, multiple universe realities might be out there, we have to actually ask ourselves, what do we mean when we talk about the universe? Because unless we understand that, I don't know how to talk about more than one of them. So this was what confronted me when I first sat down to start thinking about these ideas. And the definition that I came up with, which seems to work okay, is I think of the universe as all-inclusive. So you might ask, if the universe is all-inclusive, how can you have multiple ones? Well, what do you mean when you say all-inclusive? You mean the universe includes everything that you can experience, that you can causally somehow be connected to, that you can smell it, feel it, see it, build an instrument that can actually be connected to it or see it in some sort of way. And we might argue that the universe would encompass all that we could ever experience. And so then you could ask, is there something outside of that? And I maintain that there are a number of scenarios where things are different. So let me pull out one that I think isn't even all that contentious among scientists if they stop and think about it. We have a lot of reasons to believe that the universe, that the reality that's out there is actually much larger than our observable universe. And even if we wait forever, our observable universe will only cover a fraction of that great reality. And the reason is because we live in space that's expanding. And it turns out, through some weirdness we can talk about, but it turns out that the space expanding, if you think about raisin bread dough, if you look at the distance between the raisins as the dough rises, you find that raisins that are further from one another will move apart faster than raisins that are close to one another. And the reason for that is because there's more dough rising between them. And it turns out that that's what we see in the space and in our observable universe. We see that galaxies that are further away from us are actually moving away from us faster. So what that means is in our observable universe, as you wait longer and you look further and further out, in fact, that space is moving away from you faster and faster, and eventually it will reach the point that it's moving away faster than the speed of light. And it basically means that even if you wait forever, you will never be able to sample or be connected to a part of reality that is any larger than that. So we actually do live in a finite piece of the great reality. And so then the question is, well, is it really true that there is a reality out there that is greater than the size of our observable universe? And there are lots of there are a number of fairly compelling scientific reasons to believe that there is. That so there's an example of a reality out there which is not, will never be part of our reality. And so that is a form of a multiverse, if you will. You can argue that there are regions of the reality that we will never be causally contact with, and so that would be one form of a multiple universe reality.
Man, you know, it's weird because the reason, and this is kind of funny, but the reason I got into this as a kid, I used to read a comic book called Micronauts, based on a toy line, who'd have thought, right? And a toy line by Ideal Toys.
Yeah, I think my first experience with multiverse was probably Pink Floyd's Dark Side of the Moon.
Yeah, that was. Yeah, that and hanging out in Russell's basement.
But that's right.
Yeah, that was frightening. So when you talk about multiverses, is there a way when you talk about these different layers of the universe, and maybe even going into physics, the different planes of existence? Is there a way, do you think, that we could traverse these barriers?
You know, it's funny. I get asked that particular question a lot. I think people really would love to be able to do that, and I have a deflating sort of answer to give to it, I'm afraid.
Well, then we're done here. Click. No, I'm kidding.
Time travel is real, I know.
It better be.
But time travel is, and if you want to, I mean, if you, I can, time travel is real. I can send you into the future. I just can't send you back into the past. And if you want to come back to that, we will. But that's not even contentious. That's relativity, and there no physicist
will argue that.
Their salt will argue against that one. And we can talk about that in a minute if you want.
Okay. But,
wow, what was the question? I'm sorry. I'm not actually in Russell's basement.
Right? Dark side that's of right. the moon, I think, is where we were.
No. Yeah, if you start hearing the scary things, yeah. And in Russell's basement, we don't even want to talk about the sounds you'd hear there, along with the screaming.
No, I remember now. We were talking about traversing between the
two. Yes.
Yeah. Well, if you go back to how I defined it, basically what I say is, if when I define the universe, it's anything that we're causally connected to. And so if we figure out a way to sort of enter into a region of the multiple universe reality where we haven't been able to go before, basically that piece then becomes part of our universe because we can get there. We can see it. So if they can get here, in a sense, they become part of our universe or their reality. So that's a bit of a downer of a way to look at it. The other thing to say is that truly at this point, when you talk about multiple universes in quantum mechanics or in cosmology, you are talking about regions of the reality where we just simply cannot possibly conceive of having any connection to it at this point. So in that sense, the answer is no. However, right, one of the things that most scientists I know, and certainly personally me, hold very dear is the fact that, look, I don't know everything, right? And science is just... The history of science is littered of things that we thought we knew perfectly well. So it turns out that Newton's theory of gravitation is not perfect. It's not right. It works really well under most circumstances in which we try it. But if you really want to do things right, you have to use Einstein's theory of general relativity. And it could be someday we'll find something goes beyond that. So hopefully, I mean, it's a pretty exciting thing out there, and people are still exploring. So hopefully we will discover new things and perhaps be able to penetrate into regions of the reality that I would consider not attainable right now.
Well, you know, that kind of brings me to the thought of, as we're talking about parallel universes and different levels of existence and things, a lot of people that are involved in the paranormal field, they see these things, the shadow people, for lack of a better term, and what it seems to me, because I've actually witnessed this, was, you know, when you used to have the old antennas on the TV, the old rabbit ears before the days of cable, and you'd be watching a TV show, and there was another TV show kind of bleeding in, and you'd see like a figure, like a kind of floating across your screen that was kind of a shadow. It almost looked like a different frequency trying to break through the frequency you were on for that TV station. It looks like when you're there right in person, I mean, this thing looks like it's going across, but it doesn't even seem to know that it's walking through a wall or whatever it's doing. It seems to be like a different frequency trying to kind of modulate on where we are. How would you answer something like that if someone were to ask you about that kind of thing?
I get asked that particular question a lot. In particular, people are wondering if ghosts are some image from a parallel universe. The other question I get asked is about UFOs and such. And so they both have they have slightly different questions. I'm not sure what to say about the whole ghost thing. I mean, as I say, if in fact these are somehow images from a different thread in the many worlds universe of quantum mechanics or something like that, the connection is just not anything that I have ever seen or heard of in scientific theory that we know about. So that would lie in the realm of stuff we've yet to figure out.
Gotcha.
So I don't even know what to say about it. As for the UFOs, if we make some assumption, let's assume that they are from some other place, that they're real and they are from some other place, then I think saying that they somehow are popping in from another universe seems to be a bit of a stretch, given that our own very well understood universe is so big and surely has life in many, many other places. Now, again, there is a stretch there, because even if you calculate how much energy it takes to even try to get to the nearest star, it's pretty daunting. So,
well, to our knowledge anyway, to the knowledge of the human race,
to the physics that we know, the whole idea of interstellar travel is still a long ways off. But nevertheless, I mean, again, in the spirit of, you say, well, we don't know everything. So I tend to think that, look, if the UFOs are coming from somewhere else, it's certainly a simpler thing to basically assume they're coming from our universe rather than another. But who knows? I mean, I would love for nothing more than one of them to land in the quad by my office so I can go out and ask them.
Do some research. Yeah.
Wouldn't we all, actually?
Yeah. Where'd you come from? Is that Pink Floyd I'm hearing on this? Yeah.
You came from Russell's basement? I can't believe that.
Well, that brings up a good point, though. Does quantum physics get us any closer to being able to travel to the stars? I mean, is that still you talk about being able to bend light, you know, the gravitational forces in the universe can bend light. You know, it seems like you'd be able to bend space as well.
Well, I mean, quantum physics is certainly leading us to understand many things better. We don't know yet how to travel to the nearest stars. We don't know yet how to bend space to our will. I mean, anything with energy, actually, in Einstein's theory of general theory of relativity, actually bends space, but it just takes an enormous amount of energy or mass to bend it a lot. And we don't really have that kind of energy at our disposal. So it's hard to say whether eventually, I mean, I think that if we're ever to make it to the stars, then people need to continue to do fundamental research in quantum physics and in other areas and continually learn. I mean, we live in, if we go back into the 1850s, it was a different world. And guys like Maxwell and Faraday and Hertz and others brought us into an electromagnetic world by working in their basements and figuring out electricity and magnetism. And look around you now, and everything you do has to do with electricity and magnetism. So it's really core to our understanding of the universe, and yet really not so long ago, nobody understood that stuff. So who knows where we'll be in 150 years.
That's true. Yeah.
These are reasons why it's really important to fund fundamental research. When economies are tough and people are tightening their belts, there's always the temptation to cut the research which is being done where someone can't really point at, yes, I'm making a better toaster, and so, you know, we will have more jobs tomorrow because of what I'm doing. It's you can't really make that argument crisply in fundamental research because you really don't know what you're going to find. But I sort of think of cutting fundamental research a bit like eating your seed corn. I mean, who knows what you're going to get, but the transformation that will come about from it is lost if you don't actually continue to work on it.
Let me talk to you about frequencies, because in the world of physics, how do you feel, quantum physics, about frequencies? I know that frequencies, like everything here, is a frequency. The table is a frequency. Sure, things aren't falling through now, but if you go bending the frequency, our cups are going to fall through onto the floor. That kind of thought. That's kind of what was behind the Philadelphia Project and these different...
Resonance frequencies.
Right, these whole frequency... and that's again, goes back to the people talking about, well, we're seeing into another area because the frequencies in this part of this building or the ley lines are playing with the frequencies. That's why you're seeing these shadowy figures or whatever. What do you guys make of this frequency theory?
Wow, you just left me behind in the dust. I'm not sure. I think there's a disconnect between, and you're not the only person I've heard this from, right? I have heard people use the word frequency in a very powerful way, sort of a catch-all, blaming this and that on frequency. And I got to say, this is the point where the scientist in me just, when you say frequency to me, it means nothing sort of like that. I mean, there may be some association, but I have to think about it. So frequency comes when you talk about any sort of wave theory. So
right.
The frequency, basically, if you're standing at the beach and you say, how many waves per second pass my feet, okay? That's the frequency. And so light, for example, we perceive differences in the frequency as different colors. If we look at particles, and in quantum mechanics, what quantum mechanics is really is a theory of particles where we view them as waves, because we determined that they actually have wave characteristics, so
right.
We had to make a theory that would do that. And these waves have a frequency, so it basically depends on the energy of the particles. So in the mathematics of these theories, the frequency has very much a definition, and it does get tied in with the wave theory of things. But I guess I don't really understand how the word is used.
Right, it seems like a different definition between what you're doing and what maybe they're talking about, because the
people sometimes use energy the same way. You know, they'll talk about, oh, he's emanating energy or whatever. Well, energy has very precise scientific definitions, and they work very well. So I'm not quite sure what you mean.
Well, yeah.
Well, I think that has more to do with vibration. I mean,
that's what we're talking about here, the frequency, the vibration frequency, yeah.
Right. So certainly you can have resonant vibrations of mechanical things. And it does get tied into modern theory. There is an area called string theory where, in fact, fundamental particles are modeled as if they were vibrating fundamental strings, little tiny quanta, basically you think of them as linear. And so that's another place where resonant vibrations come into play, because what a resonant vibration is, if you're looking at string, you know, if you strum a guitar, for example, you get a nice note when
sometimes
when the frequency is such that the wavelength is an integral multiple of the length of the string itself.
Right.
And so only certain frequencies will play nicely on a particular stringed instrument or a particular string. And so the fundamental frequency and then multiples of that, the harmonics. And so you can sort of play the same game in these mathematical models of string theory. It gets pretty nasty. The mathematics is very nasty because they have to worry about the fact that things can move very, very fast. So they have to use relativity and stuff. So it's a complicated business, but it does have within it the concept of the fact that the different particles are different resonant excitations of the strings, for example. Mm-hmm. In the early days of string theory, that was sort of the picture they were trying to come up with. And they've certainly had some success. They haven't made a theory that I would say is workable now, but they certainly have come up with lots of pretty interesting ideas. And in fact, in my book, there's one string theory inspired multiple universe, which is a lot of fun.
Yeah. Tell us about the book here, because we are running low on time, and I wanted to be sure to get all that information out for our wonderful friends out there.
Okay. Well, I think the book is very, very accessible. As I say, I wrote it basically to be a survey of the different multiple universe concepts that are out there. To me, the book is really covers a lot of ground. It's certainly not fluffy, but I do think it's very accessible. So
sounds very comprehensive.
It certainly gives you a comprehensive overview as of now. Hopefully there will be even other multiple universe concepts, and as we're talking, they're being developed.
Yeah, they're happening right now.
So where can you get the book?
Amazon or any, you know, your favorite online thing, possibly in a bookstore near you, but probably not in the airports.
Steve, I want to thank you for not only being a great sport, but also for blowing our minds here on the show tonight. Man.
My pleasure. It's fun stuff.
It is. It is really fun, and it is mind-boggling. And that's the thing, when you're sitting there at night, start thinking about stuff like this. I urge all of our friends out there, let your mind wander into the billions and billions, to quote Chris and his good buddy Carl Sagan, of possibilities in the universe. And thanks to amazing people like Steve Manley here, we are moving forward all the time in our understanding of quantum physics. So Steve, thank you again, man. It has been wonderful.
My pleasure.
You have a wonderful evening.
You too.
Thank you, Steve.
Good night.
Man,
that was a great.
Yeah,
that was great.
Man, I can't even. Man, my mind is blown.
Again.
Denied.
Oh man! I tell you something funny too, because anytime there's like a weird sound, anytime there's a bizarre sound, or anytime that something goes like a little loopy or gets really in depth, Amanda looks at me with the Elvis lip. Have you noticed the Elvis lip?
Oh no!
She does the Elvis lip.
Give us the lip.
It's a weird Elvis lip thing.
I can't do it on cue.
Denied again.
I know. What is this, man? Come on.
Denied.
I'm not even going to, you know, there's
I
something
like
wrong.
We're done. Lay off the Ewoks.
There's something to be said for Chris.
I am voted on did it again. It's so sexy.
Nipple.
Yeah, baby.
Oh, my God.
It was an accident.
Jeez, man. Get ready, because we're going to play our game, everybody, all of our good friends at home. Here we're going to have five questions. Amanda, get your pen ready in there, and Chris. Sure. You guys are going to basically give an answer. Try to get it right. If you can't get it right, put down anything you want.
Okay. Potatoes.
Yeah, you could put potatoes. It would be weird. But all right, here's our first question. Now, originally this question was, where do Wookiees live? Now, and my answer would honestly be any damn place they want to. So instead, I'm going to say, where do Wookiees come from? What is their home planet?
Where do they come from?
Yeah, what is their home planet?
What do I win when I win this?
So hopefully our friends at home are getting this too. Number two, everybody, we're getting ready for number two. Chris, did you write down number one yet?
Yeah, I got it.
Okay, Chris is running down. He better do something. Number two. Okay. Now, Anakin Skywalker, who later becomes Darth Vader, was born of immaculate conception, much like another famous person in history.
Okay.
But the one thing that really set him off, that really alerted the Jedi of his existence, was something that he possessed, something in his blood. What was it that he possessed?
I know this, but I can't think of the word.
That's number two. So here comes number three. Number three. Now, this is all because Star Wars has been released on Blu-ray. If you go to the Jackalope Radio Facebook page, you'll see some cool pictures. We went up and did the midnight event, and I had the Darth Vader suit out and did the whole nine yards. It really turned out really, it was a lot of fun. They had cupcakes I couldn't have. So here we go. Number three, Boba Fett wears a specific type of armor for his outfit. What type of armor does Boba Fett wear?
Where do you come up with this?
These are easy.
This come is on. Not in the movie.
It is in the movie. Chris, write it down.
You got it right.
Instead of telling me off.
Golly. You know, this is, you know, I'm going to have to tell you.
Chris, get off Google.
Okay, I'm off Google.
Stop Googling.
Damn it.
Never rub another man's rhubarb.
Now, what planet? Now, this is a good one. Princess Leia's home planet. What's the name of the planet? It was destroyed by the Death Star.
Oh, man.
That's number four. Yeah. Our friends at home are playing along. Lord have mercy, listen to this.
That one I knew. Okay.
Number five, then this is our last question of the night for this, to celebrate all things Star Wars. Number five, what's the name of the band that plays in the cantina in Star Wars? And, for a bonus, what's the actual name of the cantina? So it's a two-part question. What's the name of the band that plays in the cantina? And if you want to go for the bonus, what is the name of the cantina? Okay. So you guys got all your answers. Amanda, you're going to have to pass yours out to Chris.
I have to rewrite mine.
He was already losing it over here because he knows.
What? Stop laughing.
He snorkeled. What is the snorkeling? Okay, Chris.
Somebody yanked his train.
Okay, here's Hugh's answers. For number one, what is the planet that Wookiees originate from? The Mystery Machine.
Somehow. I don't know how.
I think
Wookiees,
I was right, man.
But number two. Wow. What
about my answer?
I'm going to get there. What does Anakin possess? Scooby-Doo? He possesses Scooby-Doo. That's what makes him special to the Jedi.
That's right.
Number three. What armor does Boba Fett wear? Shaggy. He wears shaggy armor.
No, it doesn't sound very good.
And, he must have bought it at the rug store. Number four. What planet that Princess Leia used to live on was destroyed by the Death Star? Velma. Planet Velma, ladies and gentlemen.
I like that planet.
Yeah, Hugh's on a one track tonight. And finally, what band plays in the cantina? He never gave me the name of the cantina, but he did give me the name of the band. It's Fred and the Shaggy Dudes.
Oh, yeah.
Wow, that's a cool name.
Wow, that's kind
Fred
of frightening.
And the Shaggy Dudes.
Kind of frightening. Now we're going to go check. Chris is here.
Beth will be proud of me.
Yeah, you know what? She will. Chris's deal is what is the name of the planet that Wookiees come from? Chris said Budweiser.
Oh, my God.
What, that's not it?
I thought those were three frogs that lived on the planet Budweiser, remember?
Right. Yeah, I forgot about the frogs.
You know he's going to regret doing this, man.
Yeah. Jesus. What does Anakin possess that caused the Jedi to take notice? And you put ceramides?
Claramines or something.
Whatever you put, it sounds like a bad sinus medicine, Chris. Wow,
wasn't it?
No. Number three, what armor does Boba Fett wear for his armor? The hard kind.
Is that not right?
Well, it's better than a squishy, right?
I guess it's better than wearing Stretch Armstrong all over your body, I guess, at this point.
Right.
What planet where Leia lived was destroyed by the Death Star? Chris, ding, 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 Alderaan.
Oh, I got that one.
He spelled it really funny, but he got it right.
Whatever.
What band plays in the cantina? Band, he says Stevie Nicks.
Oh, I know that one's right.
I think if it's a band, it would have been Fleetwood Mac. But yes, that's wow. And now we're going to...
Five for five, Hugh.
Now we're going to go over here to Amanda's answers. Lord only knows where this is going to take us. Number one, what is the planet that Wookiees come from? Where did they live? Kashyyyk. She doesn't spell it right. She spells it like Caddyshack. It's kind of frightening.
I was right. It said it sounded good in my brain.
Hey. What does Anakin possess that the Jedi noticed so quickly? Worf blood. She would only know that because she's a online gamer. Worf blood plus 100 XP. Now we know why the show didn't start on time. She was playing World of Warcraft.
Hey. Whatever.
Number three, Boba Fett's armor. Beruvian Teflon.
Ooh.
Wow.
Put that in your dishwasher, man.
That
I bet that would be a slick one.
Yeah. Okay, number four. Wow. Okay, what planet where Leia used to live was blown up by the Death Star? Alderaan. She got the ding, 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 ding. Two, right? What band plays in the cantina? And for extra points, what's the name of the cantina? She says... Pelvis Elvis is the name of the band, which is frightening to me. And Little Mos Eisley is what she says is the name of the cantina.
Oh, that was the town, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was, yeah.
I was in the same vicinity.
Never rub another man's rhubarb.
Yes, yes. Now we will give the answers to all of our friends at home that are playing. Where, of course, do Wookiees come from? What is their home planet? Kashyyyk.
Yay.
Ding, 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 as Amanda got that right. Caddyshack,
you know that,
of course.
Did you
nope.
know that?
No. What is it that Anakin possesses that the Jedi took notice of, and that's the amount of metachlorians.
That's what
metachlorian.
I said.
No, you said cyclotron or some crazy cyclist, you know what you said? You said Sudafed. That's what you said. It was terrifying.
It's the same thing.
Okay.
It's the other name for it.
Boba Fett, much like his father, Jango Fett, wears a certain type of armor. And that armor would be Mandalorian armor.
Oh, I knew that.
Like a mandolin? Like you play a mandolin?
Mandalorian. No. It's a Vulcan. Amanda.
All right, now, what planet, of course, was destroyed by a Death Star? Leia used to live there. I don't even know why she picked that planet when they said, "Tell us where the plans are." Why would you name home? I mean, seriously, Leia, come on. You couldn't think of anything else in that. You were just put on the spot, right? I'm glad she's not on Jeopardy.
She could have said where the Wookiees were from.
Well, no, that wouldn't have been nice. Because then Chewbacca would have took a big old hairy. What ended up happening there? It was Alderaan. That was a good one. You guys got that one right. And what band plays in the cantina would be Frigren Dian and the Modal Tones.
See, I would never have known that.
Frigren Dian, I think is how you say it. Dian. And the Mobile Nodes. And, of course, the name of the cantina, Chalmun's Cantina. Yeah. Chalmun's.
That was my second guess. But.
I thought it was. And,
I like Elvis's pelvis.
Laugh it up, fuzzball.
I'm going to call it a tie just because
cool.
All the answers were so good, and I especially really enjoyed I enjoyed Budweiser being the the planet of Wookiees, and Ceramids, whatever Ceramids are, being what's in. Yeah, that was great. And of course, you can't go wrong when Anakin possesses Scooby.
I like Shaggy.
I mean, come on, that was pretty frightening. Now, see, this is the kind of thing that every once in a while we'll pull out things like this, and it's a lot of fun. I think just to kind of test one's knowledge. All of our friends out there, everybody, please go and pick up the Blu-ray set because it is absolutely stunning. I mean, they did an amazing job. 9 discs, a lot of good stuff there. A lot of extras that have never been out before. A lot of deleted scenes. But I had a good time, man. Thank you guys for playing. That was
no problem.
Fun game. It was fun. All of our great friends out there, stick with us. We're going to be interviewing Sybil Danning. Can you believe it?
No.
Oh, my goodness.
Swing, swing. Tentpole. She's a babe.
She's magically babelicious.
She tested very high on the strokeability scale.
Strokeability scale.
She is the bomb, man. She is the bomb. I'm so excited. She's been on the show before. She's going to be back right after this.
Hey, this is Tom Atkins. You're listening to Night Watch. Thrill me, man.
Happy, happy Halloween, Halloween, Halloween. Happy, happy Halloween, Silver Shamrock. Happy, happy Halloween, Halloween, Halloween. Happy, happy Halloween, Silver Shamrock.
It's almost almost time, kids. The clock is ticking. Be in front of your TV sets for the Horrorthon. And remember the big giveaway at 9. Don't miss it. And don't forget to wear your masks. The clock is ticking. It's almost time.
Happy after Halloween, Halloween, Halloween. Happy after Halloween, Super Shamrock. Happy after Halloween, Halloween, Halloween. Happy after Halloween, Super Shamrock.
And now, back to Night Watch.
Yoda, this is And Listening to Night Watch, you are, and will continue to do. Foreseen it. I have. Yeah.
Night Watch, a Jackalope Media production, with your hosts, Todd Sheets, Hugh McClanahan, and Chris Weisbach.
And welcome back to Night Watch. I'm your host, as always, Todd Sheets. Very glad to be here with you today. It's just a spectacular day for me because we're revisiting with an old friend of the show here and one of my very favorite actresses, not just in the horror genre, but in action. When I think of action, I definitely think of the next actress we're going to talk to here and one of my personal heroes.
A living legend.
Everybody, welcome back to the show. The amazing, the incomparable, the one and only Sybil Danning. Sybil.
Good morning, Todd. So great to talk to you again. It's been a while.
It has been a while, and it's just any time I get to talk to you is a time for celebration because you are, like I said, one of a kind. And really, ever since the first time I really discovered you, I was at the drive-in theater with, of all people, with my grandma and grandpa, because they used to drag me. If my mom didn't drag me, my grandma and grandpa dragged me. I lived at the drive-in, and we watched it all. And I remember this fantastic film called Battle Beyond the Stars, and there you were, the Valkyrie, larger than life. And from that moment on, you've had a fan for life.
Well, I was just going to say, if you went with your grandma and grandpa to a drive-in, it couldn't have been a number of movies, but certainly Battle Beyond the Stars. And wow, well, what a circle closing, because I don't know if you know, but Battle Beyond the Stars just now surfaced again, and it has a whole other life. I mean, it is one of the classics, of course, based on Akira Kurosawa's Seven Samurai. It then came out on video, of course, and you remember when it came out on NBC television, where they had to rotoscope my chest because my battle outfit was a little bit too revealing for television. And now it's coming out on Blu-ray. It's already been released on Blu-ray. Actually, I just got back from the San Diego Comic-Con together with John Saxon. We were there promoting the movie for Shout Factory, who just brought out Battle Beyond the Stars on Blu-ray. So all my fans have a new means of seeing the movie all over again.
I do have the Blu-ray. I had it like the second it was released. I was standing there ready to
now
go.
That's what you call a loyal fan. Thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you for all the years of wonderful entertainment. But, you know, I remember, when I was younger, I would go to the drive-in, and there were movies there like Naughty Nymphs, you know, were released over here, and
you didn't go with Grandma and Grandpa for that one.
No, that was my mom would go to those, and I was supposed to be asleep, but I was never asleep. I was like, I gotta watch this. And, you know, my first childhood memory was like Night of the Living Dead and The Boy Who Cried Werewolf, and movies like Naughty Nymphs, you know, Blazing Stewardesses. The thing was, even though they had these titles, these movies had a tongue-in-cheek humor. They were more like a Benny Hill episode than they were some of the stuff that you saw later, you know, in the late 90s, or the late 80s, you know.
Well, the German titles were so much more serious.
They were. Yeah, I mean, because they would always swap things out whenever, they would release the same movie under several titles during that time period in the 70s.
Well, I had done not only The Stewardess, but they all called them reports, because at that time, they got away with what they did, and they just called them reports. It was reports on, you know, how stewardesses live and their sex life on the trip, and then the housewives report, and then I did, I have, let's see, it was this paragraph, a special paragraph, which had to do with the abortion report, and et cetera, et cetera. So those right. movies were very, very popular at that time, and they were all something like stewardess report, housewives report. It was all very serious. So blazing stewardesses, I like that. More like the movie.
It was constantly something going on like that, and exactly what you're saying is true. I have quite a collection of those films. They've been releasing them in their original format, in the original German language, and they've been doing a pretty good job of that over at Synapse Films, and they're just getting around to getting to more of the report films, but they've been doing the student report films and what parents consider shocking, you know, things like that. Those are fantastic.
So your German must be pretty good by now, then, huh?
I'm trying.
It's sprichst du auch ein bisschen Deutsch, Todd? Ja.
I'm working on it. I watch a lot of Japanese films too, so I've been learning Japanese by that too. It's like, man, I get
good.
So many languages, you know. So that's the thing I love about the current age of film, is because not only is it keeping your entire catalog of movies alive, it also it introduces them to a new audience every year. And that's the thing, you know, like for Battle Beyond the Stars, my daughter just got to watch it for the first time. You know, she's 11, and she got to see it, and she was like, wow, this is a pretty good movie, Dad. And I was like, exactly, this it is a good movie. And when compared to what's out there today, it's even better, because unlike the CGI fest that we have today, a movie like Battle Beyond the Stars had heart, it had great characters like yourself, and it had a good script.
Absolutely, and I mean, nothing against all the comic books and graphic novels they're doing now, but CGI has taken over. I mean, listen, there's nothing against the great costumes they have, like I always had too, but you're right. Battle Beyond the Stars falls in that classic, old-fashioned category of everything you just mentioned, and it's never going to die out. My brother's daughter, I'm going to get her the Blu-ray. She has it on DVD, and I gave her the screenplay because she wants to become a writer, and I told her to watch the movie and study the screenplay. So it's, yes, many, many generations. That's good.
It is. It is. It's that's one of the most amazing things, is the fact that I'm able to pass that down, of course. And I have to admit, I come from a long line of, you know, my father and my mom. Everyone loved film, and they loved especially these kind of movies. These were, the funny thing was, they classified them as the B picture, but when it came to movies like Battle Beyond the Stars, you know, they would pair it up with something like Star Wars or something at the drive-in. But, you know, I think actually Battle Beyond the Stars was paired up at the drive-in with Buck Rogers in the 25th Century with Gil Gerard. But the thing was, I always liked the, and people have to realize the term B picture didn't mean it was a lesser picture. That meant it was the picture, the second on the bill. That's what that actually meant, and that's where the term B picture came from. And a lot of people enjoyed the B pictures better than the A pictures during those times.
Oh, absolutely, and I am an avid offender of that, because I always say, it's interesting what you said, I never knew that, and what I've always been saying is the only difference between A and B is the budget. So if you watch Battle Beyond the Stars, or you watch Transformers, it's only the budget. That's the only thing. I mean, and don't forget, I mean, people have to realize this was a Roger Corman movie, the biggest budget he had ever done, and it was done in his little studio in Santa Monica, where I remember in my dressing room the mushrooms were growing on the walls. It wasn't in the best of condition, but we all had fun, and we all loved doing what we were doing, and so, you know, I was doing the bee movies, and when they call me the Queen of the Bees, I'm actually very proud of that title, because Angelina Jolie is doing the same thing, only in studio movies. So when, you know, Tomb Raider came out, the studios were doing those movies. But in the 80s, when I did them, the studios weren't doing them, because it was the Reagan era and the Macho era and right. the Rambo and Commando era. So the only way women like myself could do those kind of roles were with the, thank God, independent producers like Roger Corman, who gave us the opportunity to play those roles.
Well, yeah, and Roger tapped into something that he already knew, and that was we were all out here. We were hungry for movies like that. And, well, you know, when it comes to, like you said, Hollywood is doing that now with, like, Angelina Jolie, and I know the Underworld movies have got a female hero, and that's a wonderful thing. But none of it's believable to me like you were. I mean, I felt like, man, Sybil Danning, I'm never going to make her mad because she's going to beat me up. That's why, you know, as a teenager, because it was believable.
Well, that's something you know, I'm proud to say I have in common with my dear friend Christopher Lee, and we did do 5 movies together.
Love Christopher Lee.
He always, no matter what role he played, including in The Howling, and me too, no matter what costume he wore, he always gave it his 200%. Took the role serious, without taking himself serious, but took the role serious and the story serious. And that's what came across to my fans, too, because whether I had, you know, blonde hair glued all over me, or I was in some, you know, incredible outfit, but I was always true to my characters, and I think that comes across, that sincerity for my roles. And I always say, if you think you're going to be ridiculous in a movie, don't do it. But once you commit to it, every actor has the responsibility to take it fully serious and give it their best.
Very cool.
I agree. And, you know, that kind of brings us up to, you'd been working a long time in film, and you'd had a while to really hone your craft by the time you got into the 80s. And that was really kind of a major driving point, was during that era, because movies like Chained Heat, really.
I love that movie.
Yes.
That's going back in time.
That's
back a ways.
Yeah.
A classic of its time, really.
I just picked up Chained Heat. It finally got released here in the States. And I got the triple pack that has Chained Heat and Red Heat, and it also has your Jungle Warriors on there. And these movies had, you know, they called them exploitation movies or whatever, but they had so much heart and so much talent behind the camera, and so many people were working so hard on them. And in Chained Heat, I tell you what, you went from being like this awesome hero, the Valkyrie, you know, and then in Chained Heat, you're like one of the greatest screen villains ever, but you're not really a villain. That's the greatest thing about it. It could have been just a scenery-chewing villain part that anyone could have played, but you brought it out, and you actually gave it dimension. So the character has got a villain side when it comes to, you know, Linda Blair. Let's beat up on Linda. But the other side of it was, it showed that you were doing that for a reason. You were doing that to hold your own, because if you let your guard down, then you could become the next Linda, you know?
Of course, yeah. And we were basically, I mean, I was fighting. It was racial, and then it was against the authorities. So it all had a reason. And again, great characters, great story, great camera. Just everything was great about it, and that's why it was successful and is another classic today.
Was it a tough shoot? It seemed like it was actually, you say it was fun and everything, but it seemed like it, man, you guys really seemed like you were in grueling conditions sometimes.
Yeah, I mean, you have to again get into your character, and you have to do everything that that is asked of you. And Tamara and I, we really had a good fight, and we really went after each other. And behind the camera, we were the best of friends. And I was always apologizing to her for being so mean. But you know, boy, once the cameras rolled, we were into it, and we were in good shape. And that was a Billy Fine movie, bless his soul. He's no longer with us. He was a great producer. I don't care what anybody said. He was a great producer. And don't forget, he was also a producer on Jungle Warriors.
Yep.
Which was another fun movie that also had everything in it to make it a good little movie.
And that's true. They kind of knew at the time who their audience was. And the cool thing about your movies, and especially in this era that we're talking about, they always, I say, delivered the groceries. It's like you ordered the movie and you got what you ordered, kind of thing. You know, it showed you this great movie poster. And you know, in the 60s particularly, they would do the, you know, this amazing movie poster. You'd get there and, man, it didn't live up to the poster. In the 70s, it started getting more and more to where it lived up to the poster. And then during the late 70s, throughout the 80s, it was living up to the poster. Now it's gotten to the point where it's kind of back to the great trailer. Movie's okay. But boy, during that time, the movies you were in, you always did exactly what you were, you know, what we thought you were going to do. You came in there and you delivered. And that was the thing, no matter what, if it's a Sybil Danning movie, you delivered.
Well, I turned down a lot of movies, you know, because I always wanted to. The first thing I always thought was my fans. What would my fans want to see me as? Am I going to play the mother of somebody? No, that's boring. So I turned down a lot of movies, which is not always easy because we all have to pay the rent. But I always looked at the characters first. And I, for that reason, I turned down a lot of horror movies because, as you know, in horror movies, women are always the victims. So when Howling came around and I was able to play the first blonde queen of the werewolves ever, I loved that because I was again in my element, and that's what my fans love.
Sybil, another one of the films you're involved in has also become quite a cult classic. Let's talk a bit about The Howling 2.
Well, I like the script, and I mean, we were shooting under difficult circumstances. We were in what was then, you know, today the Czech Republic, Czechoslovakia. It was behind the Iron Curtain. We didn't get the right costumes, hence I had to stand 8 hours, and they glued on hair, which seemed to me like eyelashes from the feet up. And what was even worse was taking it off because my skin was burning. Once, you know, anybody that's ever had a false mustache on, they know how that burns. But we were good spirits about it. And again, we enjoyed doing it. And I think unjustly, a lot of the media has really knocked Howling 2. And that reason is because it came after Howling 1. And you can't compare them. I mean, Howling 1 is a classic on its own. Howling 2 is a fun movie. That's all it is. It's a fun movie of the genre, and no one can compare that. I mean, Joe Dante is a wonderful director, and we're friends, and I see him from time to time. He was also at Comic-Con, so you can't really compare it. I think Howling 2 stands on its own and alone, and I think 1 and 2 is the best of the entire series.
I agree,
and,
yeah.
An underrated movie, but I thought it was very entertaining.
When it came out on DVD, I actually said to Chief Philippe, I said, why don't we do another one? Because, again, it was so successful. It was like number one in DVD sales for MGM. Then they sold it to Sony. And Philippe came back to me and said, you know, Gary Brandner, who was the writer of all the books and also the screenplay of The Howling 2, said, you know, there's the rights are kind of a little bit mucked up. There's still one Howling to be done out there. So why don't we just start a new franchise? So we have a new franchise now. We have the first screenplay. And so we're going to do a whole new franchise together. Gary is the writer.
Wow.
Philippe will direct, and I will. We will produce together, and I will be, again, the lead.
Wow, see, that's amazing, because I felt like Philippe was underrated as a director. I think he was given these things with very little money to work with, and people don't realize that it is very difficult, and he's done some amazing stuff. I mean, The Howling 2 has atmosphere to spare. You know, that's the thing that I don't think people really look at. It was released on VHS in such a muddy transfer that now I urge people to watch the DVD because it's been cleaned up and you can really see the cinematography's really decent in the movie. And I really think, like you said, he has got very difficult conditions. He's got very little to work with, but yet, you know, he's able to pull it out and stay strong to his convictions. And I think that's a testament to the craft of filmmaking.
Well, for all of my fans that are huge fans of The Howling, and I know I have many, they're going to be very happy because for the very first time ever, I'm going to be auctioning off that fantastic leather and brass costume that I wore at the KamikazeExpo.com. So everyone can go there and check it out. It's Kamikaze, KamikazeExpo.com. It's in Los Angeles at the Convention Center, and it's the 5th and 6th of November, and I will be auctioning that outfit on the 5th of November.
Wow.
And for all those that didn't know that, the same guy that Peter Mitchell, who did all the Mad Max outfits, did my outfits in The Howling.
Wow.
So it's definitely going to be something that will make someone very, very happy. I'm parting with it very heavily, but I figure it's going to make somebody really happy.
Well, it will, yeah. I mean, there's, man, like you said, you've got this legion of loyal fans, and that's something that really is, you know, you can't, I think people can't estimate the importance of a loyal army of fans. And it's because, like what you just said, you actually care about your fans. You care about people who follow your career, and you made decisions for your career. You turned down money even to keep your fans happy.
Exactly. First of all, I feel I can be of better use to a film if I'm used correctly, and certainly for my audience, for my fans, because, A, if the fans don't like it or like me in it, then they won't go. So that doesn't help the movie either. So I've changed some male roles to female roles for that reason, because I would get something offered and I'd say, no, that's not interesting, but how about me playing the cop? Well, it was written for a guy. I said, well, okay, so other than standing up peeing, and I can do that too, by the way. I said, hey, you know, let's be creative. So that's really my philosophy about that, absolutely. But speaking of loyal friends, you know, I'm very, very thankful to my loyal friends, because they were there also a long time when I set out, and I was not around, and they came back. And one of my most loyal friends is Jim Blogg. Jim Blogg has The Legend. The Legend is my fan club that he had going and kept going when I stepped away from the screen for years. And he now is the creator of my website, which is www.sybildanning.net.
Right.
He created the website and he runs it, and he has been a very, very loyal fan, and meanwhile has become a very dear friend of mine. So I'm very thankful to him as well.
Wow. Wow. That is, yeah, that's incredible. And I did know that he had done the website. I think, you know, that's a true labor of love, doing that stuff. And it's,
yes, it is.
Time consuming.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Let's talk for a minute about Reform School Girls. I think that's a hoot.
I thought it was very entertaining.
I find it to be just one of those movies that was ahead of its time. It was it had a tongue-in-cheek attitude, but it was well-made. And you got to work with Wendy O. Williams.
Well, yes, and save her soul. With Wendy, what you saw is what you got. We actually worked out at the same gym together, but unfortunately, I know a lot of fans thought, what, that's all? And I tried to change that, but unfortunately, I went to Tom DeSimone, the director, and I said, you know, there's something missing in this script. We need to have a big brawl. I mean, Wendy and I should have a knockdown, you know, drag-out fight at the end of our scene, and if she wants to kill me, that's fine. I just felt that those two characters were left unresolved somehow. And he said, that's a great idea. And he went to her and she turned it down. So I know she wasn't afraid of the fight, because my God, everybody knows she was the wild thing you see is what she was. But for whatever reason, she didn't want to have a fight with me. So unfortunately that never happened. That's the only thing I think was missing in that movie. But again, that's the only other woman in prison movie I did. And believe me, I turned down many, many, because they were just cheap, bad rip-offs of Chained Heat and Reform School Girls, so I turned them all down.
Right, right, and I believe that. I mean, that's because of you and Linda Blair and those early films. That became a very hot genre. Now they had been in, you know, they'd been all the rage a little bit before that with Pam Grier and Sid Haig, who's a dear friend of mine, and he had done, you know, some of the women in prison stuff in the Philippines with Roger, but you guys brought it back. It had kind of died off, and Chained Heat brought it back full force, and it became a big deal, and everyone was making a women in prison picture.
And I actually have one that I want to direct and be the warden in, and I cannot get it financed because Hollywood is so set in their ways. No, it's all graphic novels now, and it's all this, and it's all that, and women in prison, no, that's not in. And I feel that is timeless, and they always make their money, and they are easily transferable in every language, and every country loves them, and it's kind of an international subject matter. So I have it, and whenever it's right and I can get the financing for it, I will do that. It's a script that I like, and the only one that has come along since, and when the time's right, I will do it.
Man, I'm ready for that. You know what? It's a wonder you haven't hooked up with someone like Fred Olen Ray or even Quentin. You know, he's really into that kind of stuff. Of course, he's doing so much so much. Quentin is just busier than busy, I know. But, man, see, if I could get you financing for that movie, I'd get it today because I'm ready to watch it.
Well, if you know of anyone, let me know. But speaking of Fred, you know that Fred and I did do something together called The Lair.
Now,
are you familiar with The Lair?
Yeah, that's the vampire thing, right?
Well, it was for TV. The Lair is on Here TV, and it was season 3, and of the 13 episodes, I was in 6, and I, as always, loved working with Fred, and I had heard that he was doing that, and I called him, and I said, I'd love to be in it, and he went to his people, because TV is a whole different creature than movies, and he actually came back and said, Sybil, I'm really happy to say that the powers to be in the company are fans of yours. And I said, okay, what am I going to play? He said, don't worry, I'll think of something great. And he did, and he wrote it, and he directed, of course, all of them, and it was very successful with Dylan Fox. I know that he has a lot of fans out there too. He's a hottie. He was in it as well. So The Lair was something that the last thing that Fred and I worked on. And I love working with Fred, as you know. We've done a few really fun movies, and I hope to work with Fred again.
Oh, yeah. He was on the show not too long ago, and so was David Dakota. And
what a great time.
Honestly, vampires are the big deal right now, so I'm sure that's pretty popular.
Oh, yeah. Fred is the creator, the writer, the director, and producer with his wife, Kim Owen.
Awesome. Yeah, very nice.
She also produced. Mm-hmm.
And that's the thing, because David and Fred work in the same circles a lot, and David had been doing some work with Here TV also.
Mm-hmm.
Man, that's it's a small world out there. Jim Wynorski, guys like that.
Jim, yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's what's great about it, though, because everybody's still doing it. They just find a different avenue to do it, because it seems like the majors have taken over the multiplexes. You can't get a movie in theaters without pulling teeth nowadays, and it's great that there are other outlets,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Yes, absolutely.
And Sybil, you've been here, we've got a little bit of time left. You've been kind of a career resurgence again. I mean, you've gone through so many, it's like popular, then you kind of take a break, then you do more, then you take a break, then you do more. It's kind of like a cycle. And now you're back in the limelight again, because you've been doing some recent stuff with not only, and I'm ready to see this as a feature-length movie, the Grindhouse trailer you did with Rob Zombie, the Werewolf Women of the SS. I'm ready. That should be a major mainstream film right now. And also, you did Halloween with Rob.
That's right. Yes. And I have to thank my dear friend, Ken Foray. He's wonderful. He works in every Rob Zombie movie, and he's done some other wonderful movies as well. But Ken Foray is a dear friend of mine. And when I saw the Devil's Rejects, I called Ken and I said, I want to work with Rob. Give me his number. And he said, I can't do that, but I'll let him know. So within a week, I got a call from Rob's office, and it wasn't to say hello and to meet or whatever. I went in, and Rob had already set up a meeting. Okay, so you and Sherry are going to wear wigs, and you're going to play the Coop Sisters. Yeah. And so we were kind of like playing twins, and here I was already putting wardrobe on for Werewolf Woman of the SS. It was wonderful. And working with him is just incredible, because he is what I call number one director. He doesn't tell you what to do, because, as you've noticed, he kind of casts who he likes, and he knows what he can expect and what he's going to get. But if he doesn't like what you do, he absolutely lets you know.
Wow.
So with him, it's wonderful working, because he absolutely lets you be creative and have free range, but doesn't let you get away with anything. And from what I know, Rob does have quite a bit of film already shot, because we had such wonderful production value. It was like a huge movie. And I understand that, and the rumor has it, that we're going to be next. I mean, Machete got made as a full-length feature, and I know that Machete and Werewolf Women of the SS were quite the popular trailers. So it's just a matter of time, and that will get made.
Good, good. I'm ready. I'm ready to see it. I'll go out there and pick it up first thing. I'll be the first one at the theater. You know, whatever, wherever it's at, I'll be there, because that's one of those ones that I was like, oh man, you were made to play that. You know, it was just like perfect. I got chills down my spine when you came on that. I was like, oh, Sybil. So yeah, it was one of those things.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun. And when I was in the office, I actually said that I would love to be in Halloween, because I saw the pictures up and it said Halloween cast. And a member told me, someone working in the office told me that, oh yeah, they've already cast Halloween. So when we were shooting, when I had a moment, I said to Rob, I said, Rob, I'd really love to be in Halloween. And he says, wow, well, we have all of our cast already cast. And I said, yes, I know. He said, but you know what? Let me give it some thought. And by the end of that day, he came to my trailer in the evening and he said, Sybil, I've got the role for you. You're going to be the one, the last one, to be killed by little Mike Myers. And that was important to him. He says, that's an important role. It's not big, but I want you to play that. And I basically told him, I said, anything you want me to play, I will play. I mean, with Rob, if he would have asked me to play the werewolf, I would have played it, you know?
Exactly.
So that's how that came about. And he's just so easygoing and creative. He's wonderful.
That's awesome. And now, before we go, is there anything else, any information you'd like to get out to your fans out there, and how can they get autographs and contact you?
Well, first of all, on my website, I have my own memorabilia department, and so all my fans can go to my website, www.sybildanning.net, and it will take you to my memorabilia. And it will show you, I have DVDs, I have photographs, trading cards, posters, etc. So all my fans can go there, the ones that don't go to the shows. Then if I don't know, you say you go worldwide, I'm going to be at Autographica in London this October 14th till the 16th. So if anyone's going to be in London, or all my fans in London, Scotland, and Ireland, they always come down, I will be at Autographica this year.
Wow.
So you can go there and find me there. I believe the website for that is autographica.co.uk. Then, of course, my fans, I would like my fans to follow me on facebook.com/Sybil Danning, and also twitter.com/Sybil Danning. So you can follow me there as well.
That sounds awesome.
So, Sybil, what projects you have going on now?
I don't know if you remember the movie L.A. Bounty.
Yes.
I produced it and starred in it. The character from that movie, the movie is not mine, but the character is mine. And I now have a new screenplay. And I also have a Bible for a possible TV series that I am right now working on getting financing for, and it is called Ruger.
Heck
Ruger,
yeah,
is the name of my character. And it already is in development as a cloud video game.
Wow.
So I'm very excited about having my own game. I was approached by, and now he is my partner, and it's called Sybil Danning's Ruger. And my partner's name is Les Thomas. Les Thomas himself is an avid gamer. He's a video journalist for the Nintendo World Report and Critical Gamer UK, and he's also an analyst. And he started this January in Las Vegas. He went to the International CES, which is the world's largest consumer technology trade show in Las Vegas, and started the whole ball rolling. And meanwhile, he has programmers interested from Germany, because Europe is very big with the cloud, and he also has manufacturing partners in China. Fortunately or unfortunately, we did not get any here in the United States, but in China, that want to do the manufacturing, because there will be little gifts and little figurines, etc.
Yes.
I can't give out too much, but for all my fans who want to follow up on that, you just go to www.SybilDanningsRuger.com.
Wow.
So that is the website. So you can go there. It's Sybil Dannings Ruger. That's SybilDanningsRuger.com. And you can follow up on that website and see what's going on. Les will be in Cologne, Germany for the huge games.com this coming August. Well, this August. I'm saying it's already August now. And talking to our partners over there. So it's going to be quite exciting. And there's going to be many more surprises in store. But right now, the plan for our release for the first proper shooter game from the bottom up on the cloud is going to be 2012 Halloween. So
wow.
It will be a Halloween 2012 release.
Very nice.
And the box art, when you go to the website, you'll see the box art is a Ruger's 80s style video game box art. So you can see a little bit about that. It was created by one of our in-house artists and fashion designer, Keith Christopher, who is very, very dedicated to this project, as is Les Thomas.
Wow. You know, I've always wanted a Sybil Danning action figure, so that's great news for me. I'm ready for that.
That's not a bad start at all, no. Then I'm also working on my own. I don't know if my fans saw me on... the magazine, what is it called? Oh, my God. I keep thinking Fango. It's not Fango. It's the big, our biggest U.S. Horror magazine.
Well, there's Fangoria, then there's Horror Hound.
Fangoria, thank you. Thank you. I'm thinking of Fango. Fangoria. Yes, I was in the April Fangoria.
I do have that, yep.
So you saw that, yes. And they're very excited, and they're waiting. They said, Sybil, when you bring this, we're going to bring a huge article on that, because I have a, it's a vampire thriller that I'm also working on getting the financing for right now, and it's called The Last Revenants.
Ooh, wow.
So I will be in it as well. It's written by Scott Sanford, and I'm very excited about that. So that and Ruger are two very, very special projects that I'm working on right now.
Man.
And then a movie that you might not think I'd be involved in, but I'm also very, very involved in a movie right now that I'm talking, also getting financing for. It's called Solidarity, and it's based on Lech Walesa's time period when he was the head of the union in Poland. He won the Nobel Prize for Peace. And because of what's going on in the world right now, I think this is a wonderful story to bring to the screen. It's just something that is very timely right now, and the screenplay is written by a man who unfortunately is no longer with us, but he's an Academy Award winning writer, Daniel Taradesh. He won the Academy Award for From Here to Eternity, talking about classics.
Oh yeah,
and it's a wonderful, wonderful story. And I will also be playing actually Lech Walesa's sidekick, so to say. She was very instrumental in helping him fight against the Russians. She was a factory worker. So, they were thrown in jail together, and it's just another one of those great spirit movies that I'm very, very much involved in and working on. And last but not least, I'm working and writing on my book. I wanted to wait, but then I was very lucky to be introduced to a man by the name of Marshall Terrill. And Marshall Terrill is an incredible writer who said, Sybil, you need to tell your story now. So I'm writing on it, but I keep thinking there's so much more to add every day. We were on a deadline, now we're not on a deadline anymore. But Marshall Terrill is, he's a best-selling novelist for Steve McQueen Books. He's written more than one, but the last one that he wrote was called Steve McQueen, Portrait of an American Rebel.
Wow.
He also did a book on Elvis called Elvis, Still Taking Care of Business, and many others. And he is my editor-in-chief on this book. He just told me that on his movie, Steve McQueen, Portrait of an American Rebel, Jeremy Renner, you know, the Oscar nominee Jeremy Renner, who was in The Hurt Locker,
right,
will produce and star in it. And so that's going to be incredible. So he will star in Portrait of an American Rebel, and the life and legacy of a Hollywood icon. So I'm very honored to have him as my editor-in-chief, because he is very much pushing me to write this book, which I'm doing.
Wow. And I'm ready to read it. Yeah, that's great. I think that'll be an incredible story. I can't wait.
Mm-hmm.
Fantastic. Mm-hmm. Fantastic. And we got to bring you back when you release that, because we got to have you come on and talk all about it and let everybody know about that, too.
Certainly.
Oh, that would be, you know.
Can't wait so long this time, Todd.
That's right. That's right. This is like, it's like a dream come true every time I get to talk to you, Sybil. And I have to, you know, give a shout out to all of our you know, you're talking about you're going to be in England, and we are carried on the BBC. So I want to give a shout out to all of our friends at the BBC. And I urge all of them to go to the Autographica convention there and hook up with you and get your autograph and meet you face to face, something that I can't wait to do. And you have been an inspiration to so many people. You play amazing characters. You are one of the first to play amazing characters, such as the female action hero. That's what you symbolize to so many people, and you have empowered so many people to do films. Like you said, Angelina Jolie wouldn't have a career, I don't think, if it wasn't for you coming before her. And honestly, you are an inspiration to all of us, and you're just an amazing woman, and I want to thank you for your time.
Todd, I want to thank you. It's been great talking to you again. You sound wonderful, as always. And thank you for having me on, and thank you for giving me the opportunity to be able to speak to my fans out there. And may I say thank you to all my fans out there. Thank you for your loyalty and for hanging in there. And I'm going to do my best to keep going and bringing some more exciting things to the screen for you. It's not easy, but remember, whatever you're doing out there, it's not easy to do anything.
That's
right. Just believe in it, keep doing it, fight for it, and work hard, and it will happen.
Well, we're all
Thank
here.
Thank you, and all my love.
Thank you so much. Have a wonderful day.
You too, Todd. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Sybil, very much.
Fantastic.
What an incredible night of radio, ladies and gentlemen.
Fantastic.
Absolutely stunning.
Awesome.
Very cool.
And until next week,
spit to you later.
Good evening, everyone.
And pleasant nightmares.
Oyusumi Nesai. Night Watch is a production of Jackalope Media in association with Jackalope Radio, with your host, Todd Sheets, and co-hosts, Hugh McClanahan and Chris Weisbach. Featuring voice work from September Day. Also with Amanda H. and Audrey Q., associate producers.
All around me are familiar faces, worn out places, worn out faces. Bright and early for the daily races, going nowhere, going nowhere. Their tears are filling up their glasses, no expression, no expression. Hide my head, I wanna drown my sorrow, no tomorrow. no tomorrow. And I find it kind of funny, I find it kind of sad. The dreams in which I'm dying are the best I've ever had. I find it hard to tell you, I find it hard to take. When people run in circles, it's a very, very mad world. Mad world. Children waiting for the day they feel good. Happy birthday, happy birthday. And to feel the way that every child should. Sit and listen, sit and listen. Went to school and I was very nervous. No one knew me, no one knew me. Hello teacher, tell me what's my lesson. Look right through me, look right through me. And I find it kind of funny, I find it kind of sad. The dreams in which I'm dying are the best I've ever had. I find it hard to tell you, I find it hard to take. When people run in circles, it's a very, very mad.
You can also listen to Night Watch on the following incredible radio stations: World Talk Radio, Livid Radio, Hawking Radio, Planet Tokyo, Sessions Radio, Power 3201, Z106 FM, Haunted Voices Radio, K94 Rocks, Glue 92, Anomaly Radio, Mystic Age Radio, 96.3 Shane FM, Flash FM, Nomad Radio Network, Yapster FM, My Retro Rock Radio, XX Radio, 1611 AM, Australia, KBMA, Sports and Entertainment Radio, Robin Valley Community Radio, Radio Crackle, Planet Paranormal, The Black Vault Radio Network, Radio Free Bob, KCOR, WCRP AM, 1620, Rock and Talk Radio, The Point 99.1 FM, Extreme Indie Radio, Omnicron Radio, WPAZ 1370, Blast Podcast, KJO 97.3 FM, Indy 104 FM, O Radio, WDSP 101.9 Fox FM, Ghost Village, Switch Pod, Pure Country, Headcase Radio, Slack and Bracken Radio, Future World, Red Finger Radio, Catnip Radio, Scuttlebutt, The Butt at radio.thebutt.net, BNRX Internet Radio for the Extreme, KCIA, at KCIA1.com, Extreme Radio Tampa, Ryukin Radio, X100, SRN1, the 1KX Network, KJAG Radio, Random Radio, Riff Raff Radio, Exile Radio, WOQAM Radio, FCN Radio, Graypoint, Brand Name Radio, CKDU-FM, Leafpile Radio, Rocktown Radio, Bizu Homegrown Radio, WWRW, the Worldwide Radio Web, The Dust at www.onthedust.com, Radio Vox, Atlantis 102, Land's Edge Radio, Mix 94.5 FM, 91.5 FM, Ghost Radio, Jet City Radio, Hits 99.9, Extreme Radio 1077, Ghost Radio X, The Beat, Shadows of the Night, East Hill Radio, Hot 97.7 FM, 91.5 FM BVIR, Bearcast Radio, Kudia Radio, World Talk Radio, Surge Radio Network, Radio End, Dragonflight Radio, Beefy Radio, K94 Rocks, Anomaly Radio, Power 3201, and Independent International Radio, Lips 106 FM, Dragonflight Designs Radio, Indie X Radio, The Free Constitution Network, WOQ AM 1690, The Mix 94.5, AM Stereo 930, Radio Enigma, Steel City Radio. If you're an affiliate and your name is not on this list, send me an email and I'll add it as soon as possible. Remember to check out all these great stations for their own days and showtimes for Night Watch. And don't forget, you can listen to Night Watch anytime you want to by going to the audio chamber at www.nightwatchradio.com and downloading your favorite episodes for your own
personal paranormal pleasure. And as always, you can hear Night Watch live every Tuesday night right here at 9 p.m. Central on jackaloperadio.com.